Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I'm Kay Patuk, your host today. Thank you for joining me to listen in. The focus of today's program is housing, finding somewhere affordable to live in Ames. In the second half of the show, we'll be talking with guests from the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance about welcoming two refugee families who'll arrive in July and helping them adjust to living here. But first, we'll be looking at the difficulty experienced by many people who are already here in finding affordable houses for themselves and their families. The organization known as AMOS, or a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, has been studying and working on the problem of affordable housing in Ames for 4 years, and they've come up with some solutions, which we'll be hearing about in just a minute. We'll also be delving into a local issue that brings the problem of affordable housing into sharp relief. That's Crestview Trailer Park. Crestview and the living conditions there have been much in the news recently and are the subject of at least one pending lawsuit. We'll start by hearing the interview with two members of AMOS who've been active in establishing the Story County Housing Trust Fund. My guests are Jason Paul and Jan Flora, and they're here to talk about the housing situation, affordable housing, in Ames. Now, I understand that Ames, there is a critical shortage of housing, especially affordable housing in Ames, and I thought we'd begin with analyzing that problem a little bit. To what can we attribute this shortage of housing in Ames?
So ultimately, housing comes down to the amount of housing that's available and the number of people searching for housing. In 2015, the city of Ames did a rental housing survey where they found that in October of that year, there was a 99.5% occupancy rate. And industry standard occupancy rates are usually between 96 and 98%, so that you have the ample opportunity to turn over units that might need to be rehabbed or repaired. But when you have such high occupancy rates, you're looking at situations where you're driving up prices.
I think a lot of people look around and they see all this building, especially people that have been here for lived here for a long time, and they see apartment buildings going up where there used to be fields. I think some people might find it hard to believe there's a housing shortage. There seem to be too much building going on, perhaps, to some people. But that's a false perception, right?
Well, and to offer some perspective there, it takes between 18 and 24 months for a housing project to come online, like an apartment building in a cornfield. And since the population of Ames has been growing so strongly, much in part to the growth of the university, the development of housing has always been behind the growth in population. So you have more demand than you have supply.
And just to give you an idea, Iowa State University has increased its enrollment by over 40% in the past 10 years. So really the housing developments have just been playing catch up. And in addition to that, we've had a good deal of expansion in the industrial sector in Ames as well.
Right. And the university provision of dormitory space and on-campus housing hasn't kept pace with the increased enrollment.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
They have added a few dormitories. Probably.
I think that's mostly for freshmen, I think,
yeah,
upperclassmen.
I think the percentage of students who are housed in the dormitories has either remained stable or has declined slightly. Mm-hmm. So they've been having trouble catching up, too. I think about 30% of the students, as a rule of thumb, they like to have in the dormitories.
Okay. Now, you both belong to an organization called AMOS, which stands for a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, and they have taken on housing as one of the projects they're concentrating on. To begin with, as we look at how AMOS decided to work on housing, could you talk about how AMOS is structured?
Yes. AMOS is an organization that's comprised of organizations, or in the organizing language that we use, institutions. And in the Ames area, we have 10 institutions currently, and those are comprised mostly of congregations, but there are two organizations in Ames that are service provider organizations. And then more broadly, Ames in central Iowa is comprised of another 20 institutions in the Des Moines area, currently two in the Ankeny area and one in Warren County. And these groups are separated into what are called clusters. So Ames has its own cluster where those organizations meet to discuss the issues that occur there. Des Moines the same, Ankeny the same, Warren County the same. And then as a product of the efforts of these clusters, congregations and other groups will have relational meetings, both one-on-one with individuals and what are called house meetings, where they dig at the pressing issues in people's lives, the pressure points for folks, what keeps them up at night. And from those issues, then we can organize around actions to address some of those issues.
And housing is an issue that was voted to become an action item for Amos. And sometimes these action projects continue for several years. How long has Amos been working on housing?
That really began, I'd say, about 4 years ago when we did go through the process and found that, indeed, that housing was something that kept people up at night. So we began meeting as an Amos research team on housing and began talking with other organizations that have to do with housing, and it touches many of the organizations in Ames. And eventually we decided that we'd have a conference on housing that would bring together all of the, I guess you'd sort of say, the movers and shakers in the housing question. And that was organized by Amos, but involved many different organizations. And that was held in March of 2016. And the conference was called A Place to Call Home, Options for Housing Stability in Ames and Story County. And then the Housing Trust Fund Task Force came out of that meeting. And I'll turn it over to Jason.
How did you become involved with this, Jason?
I landed with Amos as a representative of my faith organization about 2 years ago. I was brought in and I had a relational one-on-one meeting with our lead organizer. And then through that, determined that my issue that I was most passionate about was housing, and became involved with the housing research team, which was led at the time by Jan. And then got involved in the planning and execution of the housing conference, and then since that time have been co-chairing the Housing Trust Fund Task Force with the Reverend Eileen Gebby from the Ames United Church of Christ. And so most of my work has been focused around getting the Housing Trust Fund in place in Story County, and then also facilitating the meetings of the housing research team.
Okay, so maybe we should talk about the Housing Trust Fund Task Force.
Yes, the Housing Trust Fund Task Force is comprised of representatives from municipalities throughout Story County, institutions throughout Story County, including the university, the Ames Chamber of Commerce, service providers like YSS, Habitat for Humanity, and is working to develop a state housing trust fund, which is a program of the Iowa Finance Authority. These trust funds exist throughout the state of Iowa, and Story County is one of the few counties in Iowa that doesn't currently have one. And these trust funds can realize quite a bit of money for a municipality or a service area. And based on the calculations from last year, the Story County Housing Trust Fund would likely realize around $200,000 of state funds for housing assistance, as well as the minimum $50,000 local match funding that has to come from within the community in order to qualify for the state funding. We're getting very close to the Housing Trust Fund being a reality. We've submitted our certification application to the Iowa Finance Authority. We are a 501c3 organization. We have a board of directors and the documentation required to operate, which is all part of the requirements from IFA. And the funding cycle for the next funding cycle will open up in the end of July of this year.
So $50,000, did you say, was that amount that's meant to come from the community?
Yes.
Now, is that raised by donations or?
It's raised in a number of ways. The way that the task force targeted raising those funds in the initial drive was getting buy-in from municipalities. So we took the $50,000 minimum and allocated that to each community and the County Board of Supervisors on a population basis. So we have reached that $50,000 threshold in commitments from the City of Ames, the Story County Board of Supervisors, and various smaller communities throughout Story County. So
they've already made that.
Correct. And some communities have given us a two-year commitment. The City of Ames notably gave us a two-year commitment, as well as the County Board of Supervisors.
Now, when you've got the fund and you're ready to go, what is the best way to approach the problem? What are you planning to do?
So housing trust funds are required by IFA to allocate the funding amounts for different focus areas. And the primary focus areas can be a range of different items, but the Story County Housing Trust Fund is currently allocated for rental assistance, utility assistance, and affordable housing rehab.
Right. Now, affordable housing rehab, as I understand it, that's one of the problems because there's very few available old houses in Ames. Assisted housing is usually in older houses.
Yeah, affordable housing stock is very limited in Ames.
Right.
As we've seen recently with the former middle school site on State Avenue, there will be more affordable housing units coming online in the next year or two. However, there is currently limited stock, and it goes back to the supply-demand problem that we've been facing in Ames for several years.
Right, and sometimes there have been old buildings rehabilitated, like the old school, but that's not exactly affordable housing now.
Oh, the Roosevelt Elementary.
Roosevelt, yeah.
Right, and those are condominiums, and they go north of $200,000 each, I believe.
Right, yes. So that's not affordable housing. So there will be some new units built soon, but that's not going to be the main solution to the problem.
Right.
So just basically these things, rental assistance, utility assistance, and affordable housing rehab.
And transitional housing as well.
Oh, like what people call homeless shelter.
Transitional housing is a little bit beyond a homeless shelter.
But it includes that, doesn't it?
Yeah. The Emergency Residence Project in Ames has a transitional housing component as well. But transitional housing is really designed to help people transition from homelessness or housing insecurity into secure housing.
Mm-hmm. And how does that happen? What's the transitional step there?
The transitional step is often subsidizing housing or providing housing of some sort in order so that they can work to find either governmental housing assistance through a voucher program or subsidized housing of that type, so that they have somewhere to be until they can find housing that's affordable.
I think another thing that's important to think about is the fact that when people have low incomes, they have multiple issues that they're dealing with. Housing is one of them. Often it's related to low wages, and often it's related to things like health care, child care. Child care is a huge portion of people's budgets.
Right.
In fact, we did a study several years ago, and we found that that was even, in many instances, was even larger than the amount that they spend on housing. And so we have to try to figure out how to deal with all of these issues.
And I think and that's, transportation is another problem.
Transportation is
really
important.
Yeah, I mean, if they have to travel to their job.
And that brings me back to the Housing Trust Fund, which is not just an Ames entity, but will serve the entire county. And it may be that, and you can comment on this, Jason, that a lot of the assistance, particularly as we think about rehabilitation of housing, is going to be outside of Ames. But because it's all in the same labor market, what happens in the outlying communities has a lot to do with what happens in Ames.
Right. One thing that's come to the attention recently is the whole problem at Crestview Mobile Home Park. It was an article in the Tribune, and there's a meeting about that. And of course, this is where people who have very limited means have been living, and that's basically being closed down now. I don't know if either of you would like to address that problem.
The origins of the problem, when we became aware of it, was last year, and the Crestview Mobile Home Park had problems with water quality. Many of they had received at least three negative tests of the quality of the water there.
And there was insufficient water for the number of units that were on the property, I believe. The well just couldn't accommodate all of them.
Yeah, I think that's true also. But the main issue was water quality. So the county Board of Health, which includes one or two of the supervisors, was about to close it. And I think this illustrates the real problems that we have, because the people who lived there, most of them didn't have a job, and many were disabled. And they really couldn't. Their rent was about half or less than half of what the normal rent would be in an apartment.
Mm-hmm.
And they simply couldn't pay the same amount as in an apartment.
Right.
And what we've seen over the years is the closing of mobile home parks.
And this isn't just an ordinary mobile home park. I understand that it was and these were older mobile homes. They were smaller than the ones that people are used to seeing now. Mm-hmm. So they're older and less expensive.
Yeah, and
on smaller lots.
A couple of years before, in 2014, the Lincoln Swing Park had closed, and a few of the people from it had moved to Crestview. And in talking with people from other towns in the county, we've also seen in one community they had a mobile home park that had 200 units in it. And they closed it and built regular apartments.
Uh-huh.
But it's very unlikely that any of the people who lived in that mobile home park were able to afford the new housing.
Oh. I thought that was the solution when you were talking about it. Yeah. So they built the mobile home on the site of the old MoMA.
Yeah.
I see. Okay, well, that brings me to my next question. When apparently it's a foregone conclusion that this mobile home park is going to close, Crestview is going to close. What's going to happen to the people that live there? Have you any answers to that?
Well, I might say a little bit about the history from last year. Amos got involved, and we had a resource fair with the residents of Crestview. And one of the things that we asked, the county had already was providing as much as $1,000 for moving costs for people. And what actually happened last year was that the owner reduced the number of units in the mobile home park to 15, which then allowed him not to pay for an operator who came in and checked the water quality on a regular basis. And it moved from supervision by the DNR to supervision by the county. It takes somewhere around $3,000 to move a mobile home. And so we asked that the county provide $3,000 rather than just the $1,000. They didn't do that. But what was interesting is that this year, when the same water quality issues have arisen, they've offered $3,000. And I like to think that that was part of the effort of Amos. And so we're thinking
so these mobile homes will be moved somewhere else. That will be the solution, or
a few of them.
Okay.
But the ownership of the mobile homes is somewhat in dispute. Probably only a half dozen of the residents actually own their mobile homes outright, and mm-hmm. And it's really kind of unclear who actually does own them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I understand some people just left them, and then other people just moved in.
Yeah.
So, yeah. But in any event, the people who are resident there now will have $3,000 either to move a mobile home or to help them with rent for somewhere else.
And those who moved last year, some of them moved across into a mobile home unit in Boone County. One person went to Marshalltown, I know, and so it'll be a similar process, I'm afraid, this time.
Okay. Well, just reading about the Crestview, it really brought home to me the problems that a lot of people have finding a place to live. I mean, it's really quite tragic.
And I think the Housing Trust Fund won't be able to solve all of these problems. But I think Amos will still have a role to play And I think ultimately we need to think about having, say, the city require developers to put money – this is just an example – put money into a fund that could be used by the city for low-cost housing.
That was Jan Flora and Jason Paul of Amos, a Mid-Iowa organizing strategy on the subject of affordable housing in Ames. This is Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, and I'm your host, Kay Puttock. The tragic problems represented by the situation at Crestview Trailer Park are made even clearer with this next interview with Margaret Janes, who is the director of the Department of Environmental Health for Story County. This trailer park has been what you might call in legal trouble recently, and there was a hearing, a meeting at the Board of Health on June the 6th, which you attended, Margaret.
Correct.
And we'll talk about what your findings were and what you said at that. But first of all, I want to talk about a related matter, which was written up in the Ames Tribune of June the 10th. And this is about a lawsuit filed against Crestview Mobile Home Park landlord, Brant Lemire, by one of the residents there, alleging that he has been harassing her, that he had her car towed away, that he had a verbal agreement with her that she could live in the, she could become a tenant in this trailer, but he refused to make the agreement legal. He refused to do the paperwork. He refuses to give her a key to her mailbox. He has cut off the water and the power to her trailer home, or at least the trailer home that she is living in. And given the legal troubles that the landlord of this trailer park is in, he has every motive to get rid of anybody that's living there at the moment. We'll get on to that, though. But first, I want to welcome you, Margaret Janes, and ask you to tell us the information you presented at this hearing on June the 6th to the Board of Health.
Sure. Thanks for inviting me here today. I'll start off by saying that about a year ago, Crestview downsized to, they were required to downsize to 12 trailers so that their well could supply sufficient water and quality of water to the existing tenants there. So that landed up leaving a whole bunch of abandoned trailers that were just left behind full of junk and, you know, the doors open and things like that. So you can imagine that, you know, a trailer park with many abandoned trailers and then 12 occupied ones caused some major problems as far as the livability of that area.
Right. Let me just make sure we got this absolutely clear. The reason there was this downsizing mm-hmm. was that there just wasn't enough water in the well for people living in about 30 to 40 trailers or whatever it was.
That's correct.
Right. Do we know what happened to those people that were living in the other trailers, where they went?
Some of them we do know because they were, Story County offered $1,000 per person to help them find a new place to stay. So some of them landed up in apartments. A few of them moved their trailers off to another trailer park, and then some of them we did lose track of. Community Services has done a really good job having meetings, reaching out, trying to help these folks. It's a very, very difficult situation to try to replace that cost of living that they had at the trailer park in the community of
right.
Ames. And the reason why the Crestview Mobile Home Park was so affordable was that they are the older trailers because it originally, when it was built, it has had only room for the smaller trailers. Today's trailers are way bigger. So this could only take the older, smaller trailers and the less expensive trailers.
About how old are they, most of them?
Oh, 60s, 70s
oh.
vintage. Yeah,
wow.
There's a few. I think two or so 50s.
Mm-hmm.
They used to be under DNR authority for their water. And DNR required them to get a manager, water manager, and then also to upgrade their well. And if they couldn't do that, they would have to downsize to get out from under DNR's authority. And now they're under the county's authority.
Okay.
Right? So about a year ago, he downsized. And then early in April of 2017, we started getting some complaints. One of the complaints was from Tiffany, who you earlier mentioned. And that instigated or triggered the county to go back out and take a look at things at the park and just see where they stood as far as providing them a livable place. So what we found, we went out there, several agencies, planning and development and the legal, and Marty Chitty, the board, supervisor.
Board of supervisors,
yes.
Yeah.
Who else? Deb Shildroth, myself. Several of us went out there and found that living conditions were not up to standard. So I issued notices of violations, 12 of them. Most of those notices were for the vacant abandoned trailers. They were, the door open usually, just junk left behind, just falling apart. And then there's the solid waste and then rodent and insect harborage.
In the empty trailers.
In the trailers and then also the trailer park itself, because there's a lot of solid waste just dumped here and there. And then on top of it.
Now, you say rodents. Does that mean rats?
I saw dead mice. I did not see rats.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
Who knows? But, the other problem was that he has started to run a landscaping business out of the trailer park. So there's huge logs and logging equipment all strewn throughout. And then he was also taking on the deconstruction material from a nearby gas station. And so large chunks of concrete were being dropped off, with these big haul trucks coming in and out of the trailer park. Just too much going on there, okay?
Mm-hmm. And some of the citations that were mentioned, and this presumably is for the trailers that are still inhabited, trouble with the electrical wiring.
Now, that is not under our jurisdiction. That is something that we noted. Alliant has called our office and complained several times, complaining that on a few occasions, they couldn't access them without having to walk through sewage, standing sewage. Same with the mailman. The Ames Post Office called and said that they refused to deliver mail until the sewage got cleaned up. Now, that was more than a year ago.
There's leaking sewage all over the site. The electrical wiring cannot be inspected, which can be a fire hazard, aside from the fact that, it makes it difficult to live there anyway.
I've even observed extension cords going from one trailer to another to get power, right through the roadway.
And you mentioned upgrading the well. What, aside from the fact that the well wasn't big enough to provide water for so many trailers, were there other problems with that well?
Well, a lot of people reported that he would bring water from, he would haul it in and supplement his water source. So you don't know if the trailer that he's bringing in the water with was sanitary, things like that. So it just wasn't, the capacity wasn't enough on the well.
Right.
I think that the well itself is okay. It needs some upgrades, but still okay.
Okay.
It's just a
capacity
issue.
But there was water coming in from unknown sources.
Yes, that. And then people would complain about the rustiness and the smell and the lack of pressure, things like that.
And some of these complaints go back a long time, and apparently nothing's been done about them. Some of them go back to 2009.
That's correct. Now, Brant would usually respond to complaints from the department.
Brant Lemon. Yeah.
Yes, he would respond. But my problem was that, these problems would exist for maybe a month, and he would only respond if I would go out there and tell him he had to do something, and then he would do it. But as a manager, and he was out there almost every day, he used to live on site, and now he lives in that subdivision a little bit north of there. But, very close. So he knows when there's problems, and he doesn't address them until he's absolutely told that he has to.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, getting back to this meeting. So we all went out, and we saw that there were problems. And planning and development, they found 12 violations. I found 12 violations. So at this meeting, Brant Lemire brought his attorney, Mr. Talbot. These violations then would turn into citations, which then is in the court system.
Right.
And there's a fine involved with them. They asked us to hold off on going forward with submitting these citations to the court system if they could have 2 months to show that they are getting things done and then within about a year have sold the property.
say the property, that just means the land. Meanwhile, the people that still live there have got to go somewhere.
That's correct.
Yes.
Yeah. So Brandt, I believe, is going to notice them very soon or has noticed them, given them their 60 days. And the county is offering additional support, financial support, for those 12 trailers to find other housing.
Which I believe they did with the people that already moved out. They helped some of them.
That's
that
correct.
They could, yes.
That's correct. Crestview has till Tuesday in August to have a minimum of 15 trailers off the mobile home park. That's their first step. And if they
haven't... Well, could that be just some of these abandoned trailers? Just get rid of some of those. Would that do it?
Well, the ones that are in his name, or in Crestview's name.
Oh, I see.
Those are the ones that have the paperwork in order to be able to move them off.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, and if he hasn't done that by the next Board of Health meeting, then we will go forward with issuing the citations.
Which means he'll be fined.
Fined, mm-hmm. Unless he goes to takes it to court and they find him, you know, not guilty of those violations.
Which sounds very unlikely that they'd find that.
I believe so.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. And it's a Landlord-Tenant Act that sort of dictates their relationship, their legal relationship.
Right.
Unfortunately, a lot of the individuals living at the trailer park do not have the resources to hire an attorney if they think that they're not being treated according to their contract.
Now, this lady who has brought a suit, Tiffany Isa, mm-hmm. How did she manage that? Do you happen to know that? To
bring a legal aid.
And you say this is what helped bring it to your attention.
Yes. Back in April, she called the county treasurer's office to complain that this was going on. And that kind of brought it to the front burner again.
And she's one person that's made this situation public, or the situation as she sees it. Presumably there's other people in a similar situation to what she is.
I believe so.
Yeah.
A lot of them have already left that have run into similar problems. Mm-hmm. And I don't think his intention was to close down. He's pretty much being forced to close down. We're working with the Boone County landfill, because that's where Story County solid waste goes if it doesn't go to the resource recovery plant. So the next step then will be doing the asbestos investigations for those trailers being moved off and then hauling them away, most probably to the Boone landfill.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the biggest job probably is finding somewhere for these people to live.
Absolutely,
right.
Yeah. And I will say this emphatically, that Story County understands that this is extremely affordable housing, but that is why we have worked with Crestview Mobile Home Park and Brandt Lemire to fix these problems and remain open. But it's just come to the point where the time has come that he closed the park and sell the land or use it for a different type of land use, because he is not able to provide living conditions that are healthy for these folks.
This is Local Talk on KHY Community Radio, and I'm your host, Kay Puttock. That was an interview with Margaret James, Director of the Department of Environmental Health for Story County. Since I recorded that interview, Story County Board of Supervisors have issued a notification that they will hold a public meeting across the street from Crestview Mobile Home Park at 5508 Lincoln Way on Wednesday, June the 28th at 6 p.m. Board Chairman Rick Sanders said the informal meeting will focus on resident concerns and seek input as Story County Community Services begin to develop detailed plans for moving tenants out of the park. The board has also indicated that besides offering tenants up to $3,000 in relocation support, the landlord should also be compensated for disposing of the trailers that have previously been abandoned on the property. Again, that meeting for tenants and anybody else that's interested is at 5508 Lincoln Way, just opposite the trailer park, at 6 p.m. on June 28th. And now it's time to welcome our regular monthly guest representing Ames Progressive Alliance. This month, the Alliance is represented by Betty Bard. Welcome, Betty.
Thank you.
And you come today, I believe, to talk about Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance, and you've brought a couple of guests here who are going to tell us about welcoming some refugees to Ames. Would you like to introduce the people?
I would be delighted. And again, my name is Betty Baird. I am stepping in this morning for the Ames Progressive Alliance to host this meeting. We are delighted to have with us two wonderful representatives, Jan Barron, who is a longtime community, state, amazing activist, and I can't go through all the number of things that she's done, and Heather Withers, who I've only met recently and is another amazing person. She is a retired Unity minister, and she has taken on a role as part of the welcoming committee for the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. So for those of us who have this as a new topic, and I am relatively new to it, could you talk a little bit about how ERA, which is the acronym, came to be? Where did it sprout from? Who's involved?
Yes, thank you, Betty. The social justice and outreach team of the United Church of Christ, which is very active in community affairs, has as a top priority the likely need to resettle refugees, and so they made that a top priority. And as the African proverb says, if you want to travel fast, go alone. If you want to travel far, go with a group. So they immediately reached out to other faith communities, to AMOS, a Mid-Iowa Organizing Strategy, which is largely composed of faith communities. And the first meeting was so successful and so phenomenal that ERA was born, which is the Ames Interfaith Refugee Alliance. And since then, they have reached out to other community and religious organizations. So now it's a fairly thriving organization.
That is a very wise proverb. I have seen it recently, and the gathering of people is excellent. I went to my first meeting recently, and I think there were maybe 40 people that came.
Yes.
So it's definitely a large group. Mm-hmm. So how many months ago was that, and how did it kind of progress over that time?
Probably late 2016, so okay. It's relatively new.
Okay. One of the events, and maybe the first event of ERA that I wasn't able to attend, but I heard about it, I read about it, is a town hall panel that was at the public library, and I want to say this might have been back in February, March. Mm-hmm. Am I correct to say that this was a way of introducing the interest in bringing and welcoming refugees into the Ames community? Mm-hmm.
Very much so. It was to let people know of the refugee situation and the possibility that we might have, we didn't know at that time, we might have some refugees coming to Ames. So to prepare people to a little bit about refugees, what the process is to have refugees come, and what people in the community can do to support refugees once they're here.
Okay. And Jan, what was it that brought you into this discussion?
I'm not sure I can remember, but we helped resettle three different refugee families and a refugee foster son. So I thought maybe from our perspective we could share a little bit of information.
Okay, interesting. So within this group of 40 people, are there a number of people who have some level of experience either by of having hosted people or worked with refugee families?
Yes, we do. We have about a dozen people who in some way or another have already worked with refugees, people like Jan and other people. So we have a pool of experience, which is wonderful, as well as some people who have not done this directly before but have a real interest in doing it.
Okay, that's very interesting. So when you have identified what you want to do as a group, how did you figure out where to start, like where to go? What was the next step?
Well, the step is that you go to they went down to Des Moines. This is before I had joined the group.
Okay.
And met with Carly Ross, who is the director of the U.S. Committee for Refugees and Immigrants. And so they talked to them, what are some of the steps for us to have refugees in Ames?
Oh, okay. Okay.
Is she director for the whole country? I think just for Iowa.
It was in Des Moines, so it was, yeah.
Yeah, I've got a question. Is there some central body that decides where refugees will go, or do these people that will be coming here have some links already in Ames? I mean, how does it decide that these two families will come to Ames, Iowa?
They always look, when they're placing people, for if they have a relative or a friend, and then generally they go and stay with them initially while they look for housing and all of the other things that they're going
to do. So that's the case with these families?
Yes.
Okay.
At least one of them.
At this point, we have fast-forwarded, and we are going to be welcoming refugees?
We are. Yes, indeed. Okay. We have two families who are coming, and both of them are from South Sudan.
Okay.
The first family we are expecting on July 6th.
Okay.
And it's a mother and her three children, two boys, 4 and 8 years old, and a 7-year-old girl. And she has a sister here in town.
And there was another one coming later then. Okay.
We don't know as much about them. The one thing we do know is that it is a family of a mother and father with 5 children. Don't know the ages of the children, and we don't know when they're coming. And they have a family member here, too.
Okay. So at this point, since Aaron knows who is coming, basically, and you've received some information about what the needs are,
mm-hmm.
how is Aaron and others going about to address what they need to support them in their jobs, in their housing, in whatever else?
Well, we work in a partnership with the Refugee and Immigrant Department. They have a caseworker who will be assigned and working with us. So they will help us with things like transportation, housing, kids getting enrolled in the school system, and so on. But we will have volunteers that will be supporting in all of those things. And one of the first things is just a welcome to the people who are coming, just to let them know that we are glad they are here and how can we help.
And I think one of the first things will be to start to look for work for them. And probably the South Sudanese will not have had experience, work experience, that would bring a high wage.
Mm-hmm.
Because for many South Sudanese, there has been no schooling. So they come with a will to survive and adjust, and language will be essential too, because they probably speak Arabic and maybe
mm-hmm.
Dinka.
Mm-hmm.
And there are several Arabic and Dinka speakers from South Sudan living here in Ames, and some of them still are currently classed refugees. There's quite a large community, and you will find them probably the women working in the hospitality, doing housekeeping in the hotels and motels. I know one of them works at ARC in one of the housekeeping or supervisory levels. Also, to find work for men will be a challenge, too, although now with the low unemployment and hiring signs all over Ames, that will be of an assistance. I know the first family that we helped settle, we were able to locate a work for him right away. This family was from Laos, and he had been a policeman in Laos. But Gary Amico of Amico Industries in Nevada was looking for somebody to work in his factory, which made small machines that they shipped to other countries. And so Tim got a job there. This was in 1980, and he's still working part-time there. So to have an employee who would work with a non-English speaker and teach the skills as he learned the language was really a gift from God, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
The second family we helped sponsor were from Bosnia, and they had been first refugees in Germany, or had lived there for a short time. So in addition to their first language, they had already learned German, but they didn't know English, and they quickly picked that up. He was the manager of a meat market in Germany, And he got a job working here in one of the grocery stores in the meat counter. But he was so disappointed they wouldn't allow him to butcher, which he had been doing for years. And because they had dreams of being entrepreneurs, owning their own company, they eventually moved to a part of Cincinnati, and they are now owners of a large restaurant. They have worked exceptionally hard, but that's an example of a contribution that a former refugee family makes to our community. The same way with the Laotians. All of their children graduated from Nevada High School and are in professions that are needed here, and they're making a real contribution.
That's amazing, and it's wonderful.
It is. Mm-hmm. They are really survivors. I often wonder if I was plopped down in South Sudan or in Bosnia, would I make it?
That leads to my next question, because I have often imagined this. I have a little bit of experience working with a family from Burma in Des Moines.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And they were similar to your first family that had no background. Mm-hmm. They were not literate in their native language. So I've thought, so what does a family feel when they arrive in Iowa, in this case, in the middle of winter?
Yes, and that's the way with our first family.
Yeah.
And all they brought were a few lightweight clothes and three nested baskets.
Yeah.
And in those days, soon after Governor Ray had been governor, there was much more support for refugees than there is now to get them started. I think now they will receive some financial support for 3 months, and then essentially they're on their own, except for some assistance with health insurance, I believe.
Yeah, they will get Medicaid.
Okay, okay.
And they will work with them through Promise Jobs to try and get employment.
Tell me more about Promise Jobs. That's a state program.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Okay. And they have a state program of training for a while, and then they hope to match. And that's been going on for several years.
Okay. So that means that the community really needs to step up more.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yes.
Okay. And how would that happen in Ames? How is that happening that the community members might say, hey, I really care about this. I want to support. What can they do?
Maybe some of the listeners remember Adi Pombasai, who came as a refugee child and at one time was principal at Marshalltown High School. He also was a much-loved teacher of social studies here. And he indicated if people would just be friendly and helpful at cash registers, for starts, that would be. And remember that these people can speak more than one language, and give them the benefit of the doubt and assist, take time, and don't ask, how long are you staying? That is very insulting to people from other countries, because that statement makes people feel that
they're not welcome to
They're
stay.
They're not welcome.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So don't say, how long are you staying? Or when will you go home? Their home is here, even though it may not feel like home at the time.
Okay.
And right now we are developing a list of resources and people who can offer different services. It might be a language service. It might be they have some furniture that they would be willing to donate. They might be willing to transport people to do things with the kids. There's a variety of things that people can do. So I would say if anyone is interested in volunteering, and I should say that all volunteers will need a background check before they can be with the family.
Okay.
But if they are interested, I will just give my email address right now, and then I can forward it. So it is all one word, H Withers, W-I-T-H-E-R-S, at centurylink.net.
Very good.
So we would be delighted. We have to be careful at the beginning not to overwhelm the family and also to match up the needs with the resources that we have. But people are so generous in wanting to give, and we just feel that's such a blessing.
Both of you touched on language.
Right, I'm interested.
Okay, we're on the same wavelength here, I guess. And I had gotten on Wikipedia, of all things, to look at South Sudan, and I noticed that English was the official language. But being an official language and being a language that people typically speak is apparently two very different things. So with ESL services in the schools, I know that children will be connected with that. What about outside of the school day, during break, summer, and particularly for adults, for the parents who don't have those kind of connections?
And also work during the day. One of the difficult things for the Bosnian family was that the English classes, which volunteers give very generously here, were all during the day, and they had jobs during the day, so they couldn't avail of the English classes. That is something that maybe could be looked at.
So we need language classes in the evening.
Yes,
that makes sense. Now, the people that give the language classes in the daytime, who are they exactly?
Mostly women, volunteers. I don't know because if they've had some training or not.
It's not easy.
It's not easy to teach. Like, no.
Just because you speak English doesn't mean you're good at teaching English as a second language.
The South Sudanese women that I know all have some fluency in English.
That brings up something else I was wondering. The people, like the families that these new families will be staying with, are they part of your group, the group that's...
Not yet. In fact, one of our questions to Carly Ross was, can we contact the sister ahead of time? Because we felt it would be helpful if we knew something of the background and so on. And I believe that we're probably not able to contact them until we've had these background checks. So we're waiting to do that.
So there's no former refugees who are now settled who are part of your volunteer group now?
There is maybe one non-native born man, but from Africa. Right.
But I think as we see what the needs are, we'll be able to reach out to the community, and I think the sister probably will have contacts that would be very helpful. Plus, the women you were talking about who speak Dinka would be very helpful. Mm-hmm. So we're sort of waiting to see what the needs are to match people up.
What I found in Des Moines were a couple items. One, that Lutheran Social Services had classes. And there were a number of churches that had classes for specifics. In Burma, there are a number of Miso Chan and so on, different languages, and people would have specifics. Mm-hmm. The other I ran into, which was very interesting, was retired people, retired ELL, retired elementary, small children, teachers, and so on, could really plug in and have those types of skills. And I'm guessing that those people were going to come out and say, yes, please involve me.
I hope so.
Yes.
I'm an optimist.
Yes. So if you're listening and you have these kind of skills, contact Heather. Why don't we give your email again, Heather?
Okay. It's H Withers, all one word, WITHERS, at, and this is all one word, CenturyLink.net.
Many of the men and some of the women who are refugees find jobs in the meatpacking industry, and that is extremely difficult and extremely fatiguing and dangerous in many ways. And, for example, one of the South Sudanese families that we know, they live in Boone. She works as a hotel housekeeper, and her husband works in Marshalltown in the meat packing. And I think it would be very hard for him to have the energy after such a day to be in an English class. So we just have to remember most Americans will not work in meat packing, and that's where many of the refugee men first get started. So we have to empathize with them and adjust our expectations.
As we close, I do want to mention, and I know you'll be closing in a minute, that we want to thank everyone for participating today. with the Local Talk, KHOR Local Talk, Ames Progressive Alliance show. And we do want to invite everyone to the APA Potluck in the Park. It is coming up on Sunday, July 9th. ERA is a participant, as are many other organizations in Ames. It's, again, Sunday, July 9th, 4 to 7 p.m., Brookside Park. Please come and enjoy fun food games. Bring your kids. Have a wonderful day. We're looking forward to wonderful weather. We know what's going to happen.
Thank you. This has been Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a program where we explore the stories, people, and places in Central Iowa. We've just been hearing from the Ames Progressive Alliance and their guests, Heather Withers and Jan Barron from the Ames Interfaith Alliance. Before that, we heard from Margaret Janes, the director of the Department of Environmental Health for Story County, and from Jason Paul and Jan Flora of Amos. Local Talk airs at 7 a.m., noon, and 7 p.m. here on KHOI at 89.1 FM. You can also hear Local Talk anytime online at khoifm.org and find links to the guests and information you heard during the program. KHOI is also streaming live online at khoifm.org. Our theme music, as always, is Backtracking by Tom Richards and Al Harris from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. Local Talk is a radio production training workshop as well as a radio show. If you'd like to try your hand at reporting, we'll train you. So come and see if you'd like to join the Local Talk team. If you enjoyed the show, please tell your friends and check us out on Facebook. We've made a change in our morning schedule. Coming up right now will be Democracy Now! And after that, as usual, at 9 o'clock, Morning Masterpieces will be on. So now stay tuned for Democracy Now! With the headline news at the top of the hour. And please remember that you, as listener, are the most important part of Local Talk. Your participation as audience and your generous donations help make it all possible. And now, thank you for listening, and we'll see you again on the radio.
Funding for KHOI is made possible in part by the Ames Chamber of Commerce. In the heart of Ames, the Ames Main Street Farmers Market brings local food and fun. Located between the 300 and 400 blocks of Main Street, including Tom Evans Plaza, the Farmers Market provides fresh local fruits, veggies, meats, breads, handcrafted goods, live music, and family entertainment every Saturday.